So now we have a period of discussion, questions and answers. Anybody would like to ask anything or say anything, please feel free to do so. In the Theravada Buddhist tradition and Pali tradition, it's noticeably free of those kinds of presentations talking about energy centers in the body, although in Tibetan yogic Buddhist yogic traditions there is quite a lot of emphasis on those things. I would assume that the Buddha felt that that was one of the things that was unnecessary to take too great an interest in. But if you, if you practice yoga or any of the or qigong or anything, you begin to experience energy in those areas, and what they call the chakras, and it would, I think it depends a little bit on your on the individual which chakra tends to be most powerful or active, whether it's there's one here, there's one here, there's one here, and here, 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 isn't there? I don't think there's any one which is necessarily more sort of fundamental than the others. In certain yogic practices, meditations, you can feel a kundalini energy that goes from the base up to the top of the head. And if you practice a lot of metta meditation, then you tend to feel in the heart chakra more. If you do tai chi exercises, then the hara becomes very active. So I think it's just things to observe and to be aware of, but that they're not, that a knowledge of these or a meditation on them is not essential to the Buddhist path, at least as it's developed in this tradition.
Is there any significance
that Yes, that's related. The sort of so-called third eye. The same with the flame from the top of the head. These are sort of iconographic representations of these kinds of energies, I think. I don't think that the Buddhist teaching is one of passivity and just allowing yourself to be bullied and just say, oh, thank you, I forgive you, or something like that. But I think that the point is that if you're not initiating or reacting to bullying and to that kind of behavior, then in one way you're protecting yourself against it. But I think it's sometimes you have to stand up for yourself, and there's kind of no fixed way, you should always in every circumstance be like that. I think with children, with boys particularly, sometimes they just have to show they won't put up with any nonsense, but it's more not taking the initiative and being aggressive oneself. Often if children have a real sense of self-possession and that they're not fearful and anxious and afraid, that they don't draw that kind of energy, there is respect for that, and that also children have to help each other. If you have children who are kind to each other and are friends with each other and stick up for each other, then that's also a protection. Bullying is an awful thing, and I don't think that there's any way you can teach a child and say now you'll be safe from bullying. I know when I was growing up, a lot of bullying in schools in England, and I was bullied at school at some points. But the boys that learn martial arts and things like that, they tended to attract more violence than the children that didn't, because when you learn something, you want to use it, and it's a kind of a challenge to other kids as well. So even the sort of make your kid tough, teach them Thai boxing or martial arts, and then they'll be safe from bullying, I don't think that that's necessarily the case either. But not contending with other people, keeping away, but having that, also not projecting the sense of fear and anxiety, and so people have a certain sense of respect and care about you is also probably a good way. I guess what I'm saying is, Buddha's not just saying be kind and be gentle and let people trample all over you, but it's like use your common sense as well. Mm-hmm. I think that there's a lot of misunderstanding around what living in the moment really entails, and if you're forgetting a lot of things that you need to remember, then that's obviously an incorrect way of living in the moment. The word mindfulness, the etymology of the word mindfulness, or one of the main meanings of mindfulness, is memory, it's recollection. So being mindful means bearing in mind or not forgetting everything that you need to fulfill your responsibilities or your duties in any situation. So being in the moment would include remembering what at such and such a time you have to do this and such a time you have to do that. So if your way of being in the present moment means you can't do that, then it's probably not right. It's not the correct way to go about it. So being in the present moment doesn't preclude memory or planning. What it does preclude is just sort of getting caught up, or just when you get bored, going off into a dream world, or just dwelling on old memories, or going over and over again what somebody said, hurtful, and so just using up a lot of mental energy, time, space, and unnecessarily. The effort is to fulfill your responsibilities in the best way that you can, and demands being able to remember things at the right time. I think the causes of forgetfulness are worth investigating. I mean, sometimes it's just we give our minds or brains too much work to do, and they just, so it's like your brain is just sort of squealing, this is too much, I can't do this. Sometimes it's a matter of being more systematic. So if the function of mindfulness is recollection, it's a pair with the what we call sanya, which is the clear perception of what we're doing. So a practical example, you put something down, let's say you put this clock down here. Now, being aware I'm putting this clock down here, that's perception. That's using, you're creating a clear perception of where something is. So in future, when you want to recollect it, which is the function of mindfulness, your ability to recollect is conditioned by how clearly your original perception of where you put it was. So if you're doing a lot of different things at once, and you haven't clearly established in your mind where you put that, then it's quite likely that you'll forget. And it's not necessarily a fault of the mindfulness, the recollection function, but of the being aware of putting it somewhere in the first place. So in Buddhist psychology, you separate these two things. If you can compare it with a computer, it's like entering data into a file and then retrieving the data. So the mindfulness is like the retrieval, and the sanya is putting the data and being systematic about where you put it so that you can retrieve it more easily. So most people make the assumption that their problem is sort of in the retrieval. My memory is hopeless, but often it's prior to that the original presence of mind when you made the original decision, or say when you decide, okay, I'm going to meet somebody at 2 o'clock. Then there's a very clear a point in your mind, so that it will come up again in future when you need it. I think we're very unsystematic about memory, and there are a lot of very simple and practical means of developing memory, which for some reason aren't usually taught in schools. There's very simple mnemonic techniques which if you do have a problem with memory, that's well worth going into. You can find these kind of things on the web or in books these days. So it's a matter of what do I need to remember, what do I need to bear in mind in this particular situation, that's like being present and doing. As the annihilate, the Buddha often presented his teaching as a middle way, and that middle way teaching was developed in various contexts. And one of the ways the Buddha taught about the middle way was between two what he considered to be extreme philosophical systems. And the Buddha said that these kinds of philosophical systems are based upon a lack of observation of the way things are, and that they are no longer it's no longer possible to to uphold them once you see clearly into the way things change, the nature of impermanence, the condition. It's not just that things change, but they change according to causes and conditions. When we see where we're in a sort of an aware, bright state of mind, and then something arises into consciousness through the confluence of causes and conditions, we see something, as it were, arising from nothing. In fact, you know, there are the causes and conditions present, in that they come together in that way. And so the idea of that when we die, that's the end. That the brain death is the end of everything, the materialist view, is undermined. I mean, it's not absolutely, you could say, disproved, at least on sort of a level of consciousness of an enlightened meditator, but it becomes seriously undermined when you see how things arise through the confluence of causes and conditions, and we see that those are not necessarily physically based. Similarly, if we take meditation to a higher level, in which we lose all perception of the physical body, and it's as if we subjectively there is no physical body, and can reach the level where there is no breathing. It's as if we stop breathing, and that kind of experience of this very bright, clear, still awareness, which is absolutely independent of any physical sense, again gives one a very strong faith that the physical death of the body is not the end of everything, that there is something which is independent. I think probably logically or philosophically we could argue that those are not absolute proofs, but they are things that do have a very strong psychological effect in that way. Similarly, as I say, seeing how things pass away when the causes and conditions sustaining them are no longer present, doesn't remove belief in other realms, of heaven realms and hell realms, but it undermines, seriously undermines, the belief in an eternal heaven or an eternal hell, when we see that, again, the way that all conditions are contingent, and that they arise, they're sustained, they pass away through the power of causes and conditions. So the belief in a fixed fate, in Creator God, the Buddha is putting forward the hypothesis here that these kinds of beliefs are based upon a lack of clear observation of the way things exist. So one's not saying, well, the Buddhist position is there is no Creator God, but the Buddha is saying that position of Creator God is unsustainable at a certain level of insight. So one of the teachings is that on the first level of enlightenment, that those kinds of views in annihilationism or eternalism or Creator God, those things disappear from the mind on the first level of enlightenment, when the insight reaches that level of stability and profundity. surrender. How would you define surrender? I wouldn't actually use the word surrender in that same way, surrender to something, but more there is a surrender of, there is a surrender of attachments. No, you don't have to do that. No, that I wouldn't look at it in that way myself, because the Buddha is questioning is the very idea that you have a will that you can surrender. And the Buddha is saying, what is that will? Where is it? Is it really yours to surrender in the first place? Well, what the Buddha is saying, understand the nature of will. So, I mean, that idea of I have a will that I'm going to surrender to a higher being or so on, it's based upon certain fundamental assumptions or premises or ideas. So rather than speaking that way, the Buddha is saying, examine those basic assumptions first. So, you know, exactly what are we talking about when we say surrender our will to a higher being? What is that right now? What does that mean? Like, psychologically, what would you do, you know, to do that?
You give up, one gives up one's ego.
Well, what is one's ego?
One's ego is that like, I can do one. I mean, I can handle every situation what comes to me. I can do it. And after a certain time, you say, okay, I surrender. I follow what you think is right for me. Let that happen.
Yeah, but who are you surrendering to?
The will of God.
Well, how do you know what the will of God is?
Whatever happens in the will of God.
Really?
Yes.
Well, then why do anything at all? Why get up in the morning?
Why get up in the morning? Because it is also believing in the fact that you are given a certain thing.
I mean, my own personal difficulty with that kind of view is that there are so many people doing so many evil things in the world in the name of God, and they're absolutely convinced. People who blow themselves up in marketplaces are convinced that they believe that that's the will of God, don't they? So you have a real problem. Well, who decides? You know, you say, well, whatever happened, well, if I blew myself up, then that was obviously the will of God for me to do that. Well, actually, you couldn't say that because you'd be already dead. But if you were going, you know what I mean? You know, if everything that happens is the will of God, well, like, what's the principle of action? Why do one thing rather than another thing? Why not just toss a die? You know, toss.
Your personal business. insight on what you do with anything that is given to you, whether you take it to good, or you bring for the benefit of mankind, or for all you do is negate it.
Yeah, I don't quite look at it in that way. I see the will as a conditioned phenomena which is arising and passing away. But you don't have a thing called a will which does this or does that. But understanding the nature of will, the relationship between will and intention, we can be deluded. So people who are deluded believe that they're acting wisely. So, you know, what's the principle there? You know, if someone says, no, you're deluded and I'm wise, you know, it's just an endless argument. And as I say, I think that this particular view it can be very dangerous in that it is the rationale for all kinds of cruel and evil actions in the world. So I prefer the Buddhist view, where we have precepts which we take upon ourselves voluntarily as boundaries for action, and irrespective of whether we feel a higher power wants us to do this or doesn't want it, we keep our precepts, and then we look at what goes on, and we can see that our will and our understanding of what is right and what is wrong is itself conditioned. It can be conditioned by the mood, it can be conditioned whether we're hungry or whether we're tired, it can be conditioned with if we just had a row with somebody or if we're in a good mood. And so the Buddha is encouraging us to not to start off with some philosophical idea about self or Atma or Brahman or whatever, but saying look at without these kinds of concepts, just try to look very closely at what's going on. And what I see, and I think what many people see, is just this kind of flow of phenomena. So rather there is a thing called a mind or a heart or a will, what we see is this flow of conditioned phenomena. So we're changing our way of looking at ourselves and the world from a sense of things acting upon things or objects, subjects and objects, to this complex interplay of changing phenomena. So it's a very kind of different way of looking at things, isn't it? Yeah.